From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across a nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast Day M. Well, June 1st already into June 2nd. This may be the fastest year I can ever remember. Emerging artists tonight for the first couple hours of bumper music, and later on tonight, a look at the supernatural with Chris Putnam. But here's what's happening. Well, founded in 1954, Bilderberg is an annual conference designed to foster dialogue between Europe and North America. And every year, between 120, 150 political leaders, experts from industry, finance, academia, and the media are invited to take part in the conference. They even have a website, but they don't put a lot of information on it. The 62nd annual Bilderberg meeting takes place, of course, going on in Denmark, in Copenhagen. Alex Jones, Infowars.com. He's got people looking all over the place. Alex, what are we hearing about this one?
George, thanks for having me. Well, this very important meeting, until just about a decade ago, thanks to your show and others, was denied. The media said it didn't exist, but you exposed it, I exposed it, many others exposed it, the late Jim Tucker exposed it, and this is a key window into globalization. A lot of the documents of Bilderberg have now been leaked over the years, even to the BBC, and you know, they brag that they secretly set up the beginnings of the European Union. So this is a key globalist meeting where a lot of major decisions are made, and the fact that the mainstream media denied it existed and told people that it wasn't real, and that we've now proven it's real, and they've been forced to put out a website to release some of their agenda points, shows that the people are really starting to discover the shadow global corporate government that's out there. And we've learned quite a bit about their agenda this year. It's really just more of the same. Establish a planetary world government, destroy national sovereignty, really empower the United Nations to remove the United States and other nations from the equation, and simply put, private central banks in control. But this year, we saw multiple Bilderberg Group members actually come out across the fence of the police and talk to the media. The leader of the Dutch parliament came out and tried to whitewash things and others. So certainly, they've gone from secrecy to being quasi-public, and now they're trying to act like that we were always public. It's no big deal.
They seem to be acting as if they need to work quickly. Alex, do you sense that?
100%. That's what's happening, because even Zbigniew Brzezinski, Obama's advisor, and Henry Kissinger and many other top globalists say that their program is about 10 years behind, and that the world is politically waking up to them, and that they're going to have real trouble bringing in this global technocracy that they call it. And again, I'm not against some type of global federation, nations working together. This is done by stealth, and the globalists, this New World Order crowd, as you know, covering them for decades, George, does not have the general public's interest at heart. They're very anti-human, and that might be because so many of the founders of Bilderberg on record, like Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, were top Nazis. So it's a very sinister group who wants to rule the world.
Okay, and we can track Alex, of course, Infowars.com and PrisonPlanet.com. Thank you, Alex. Actress Anne B. Davis, an American television legend who held the Brady Bunch together in her role as housekeeper Alice Nelson, has died. She was 88 years old. Bishop William Frey, a very close friend of Davis, says the actress died at a hospital in San Antonio, Texas, where she was being treated after hitting her head in a fall. Sad story there. And a leading neurosurgeon has controversially claimed that cyclists who wear helmets are wasting their time. Now, you see a lot of cyclists all over the place. When I was a kid, we never wore helmets, but nowadays just about everybody does. Well, Henry Marsh, who works at St. George's Hospital in London, said that many of his patients who have been involved in bike accidents have been wearing helmets that were too flimsy to be beneficial. Sleeping in a room with too much light has now been linked to an increased risk of piling on the pounds. According to a study, a team at the Institute of Cancer Research in London found that women had larger waistlines if their bedroom was light enough to see across at night. So darken your rooms. A long-awaited liftoff in the U.S. economy is facing pressure from stubbornly weak wage growth, muddying the outlook for consumers and challenging the Federal Reserve policymakers who are counting on a pickup as they unwind the central bank's extraordinary support for the recovery. They don't want to continue doing that too much longer. Listen to this one. A California man who found a bag containing $125,000 said he returned the cash to the armored truck company that accidentally dropped it because it was the right thing to do. Joe Cornell, 52 years old, said he saw the bag of cash fall out of the back of a Brinks armored cash transport car as it drove over railroad tracks in downtown Fresno. He said, I kept thinking the good, the bad devil, but I decided to do the right thing and give it back. For his honesty, a $5,000 reward and another $5,000 donation to the Salvation Army. Incarceration in the United States is one of the main forms of punishment. Rehabilitation or both for the commission of felons and other offenses. The United States has the highest documented incarceration rate in the world. At the end of 2009, for example, 743 adults incarcerated per 100,000 of the population. And according to the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, 2.3 million adults were incarcerated in the U.S. federal and state prisons and county jails at the end of 2011. And almost 1% of the adults in the U.S. population. That's amazing. Additionally, nearly 5 million adults at year-end were on probation or on parole. In total, 7 million adults were under correctional supervision. In addition, 71,000 juveniles in juvenile detention, and that was in 2010. What is going on? California, for example, spends $13 billion a year on prisons, $9 billion on education. In a moment, Doug Knoll joins us. His work, Elusive Peace. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast from George Norrie. Doug Knoll is an award-winning lawyer who has mediated thousands of conflicts. He's the author of several books, co-founder of Prison of Peace, and creator of its Pure Magic Deep Listening online workshop. Back in 2012, he was honored by the California Law Magazine as the California Attorney of the Year. Doug, congratulations for that, by the way. That's quite an
honor.
George.
Yeah, my colleague Laurel Coffer and I were honored by California Lawyer Magazine as Attorneys of the Year. It was really quite an honor.
Super. Tell me a little bit about how you got interested in the prison system.
I've been a mediator since 2000 when I left the active practice of law, and in August of 2009. My colleague, Laurel Coffer, out of Los Angeles, called me with a letter that she had received from a woman serving a life sentence without possibility of parole in the largest, most violent women's prison in the world, which happened to be located not too far from where I live in Chowchilla, California. And this woman, Susan Russo, was asking us to come into the prison and teach life inmates how to become peacemakers in the prison because they were tired of the violence. And after talking it over with Laurel and doing a lot of investigation, we both decided this might be something that it would be worth doing. And that's how it started. And today, we're in three prisons, the L.A. County Jail, L.A. County, and also L.A. County Juvenile, working with both men and women in these maximum security prisons, teaching life inmates. We teach life inmates how to become mediators and peacemakers within the prison environment, and then we train them how to teach other prisoners. And it was through that experience, and of course my deep background as a lawyer and a law professor, that really woke me up to what's going on with the prison system and why we really have to be paying attention to this. No matter what your political stripe, there's something here that should deeply concern you about how we're dealing with our criminal justice system. But in a nutshell, that's how it happened. Totally pro bono. We don't get paid a dime for doing this. We volunteer our time and work in these prisons to help these people resolve deep, deep, deep conflicts.
These statistics that I just read off, Doug, before you came on, are absolutely staggering. I mean, my gosh.
Staggering. And in California alone, and California is not alone, the one statistic you read, which is the budgetary figure, is $13 billion a year in prison. That's not even the police or highway patrol or the court system or anything else. Just the prisons. $13 billion for prisons, $9 billion for education.
Jeez. What bothers me, too, is...
It's crazy.
I think as we go to privatization of prisons, we're going to have more people incarcerated because it's going to be big business then.
That's right. And the two major corporations that provide prison services, primarily today to the federal government, to a lesser extent to state governments, of course, claim that... they do rehabilitation, but they are not paid for rehabilitating people. They are paid for warehousing people. And, you know, I don't like privatization because I don't really like prisons much at all. But if you were to do it right, what you would have to do is pay them to rehabilitate people. And they get paid by the people they save, not by the people they warehouse. If you have to do it that way, that would be the way to do it, the most economically smart way to do it.
We're going to get into Prison of Peace, your project. But let me ask you this, Doug. You know, I think there are a lot of people in prison that shouldn't have to be there. Petty crimes, you know, petty little marijuana, you know, cases and things like that. But in terms of the prison system, you're not saying let's abolish the prison system. No, not at all.
No. We need prisons. Well, we need, whether we call them prisons or not, there is a certain percentage of the population that are dangerous. They're dangerous to themselves and they're dangerous to society, and they need to be isolated and protected from themselves and from everybody else. So we will always need something, but that something is not what we have today.
Let's talk about
the monstrosity.
Prison of Peace. What's this project?
This is the project that started in 2009. We teach life inmates how to be effective mediators within the prison environment. We only work with life inmates because we know they're not getting out. And we want them to be in prison and be the long-term influence in changing the culture of the prison populations. Where we started, which was the former Valley State Prison for Women in Chile, California, was reputed to be the largest, most violent women's prison in the world. Within 3 years, we'd received a letter from the warden saying the prison had completely quieted down and there had been dramatic changes in the prison population as a result of the training that we had started there and the trainers that we had trained, the women we had trained to train this. We basically take them through a very intensive 12-week workshop training where we spend 4 weeks teaching them how to listen, we spend 4 weeks teaching them how to do peace circles, and we spend 4 weeks teaching them how to be mediators. And then they go out and they start doing the work. And the stories are unbelievable. We have had women stop gang riots in their tracks. We have had... we're working in a men's prison now, and one of the lifers that we've trained just reported last week that he walked into a cell where two men were about to kill each other and literally sat them down, talked to them, worked through the problem, and they walked away with face and self-esteem and respect, no violence. It's amazing.
And the people you're training for this, they're pretty darn hardened criminals then, aren't they?
You aren't going to see anybody harder. I mean, in the men's prison that we're working in, most of the inmates have been serving hard time for 25 years or more. And what's really amazing, George, is when you walk in, we walk in with no judgment. We just tell them, here's what we have to offer you guys. And if you do what we say, it'll change your lives. And it does. And not only does it change their lives, it changes the lives of everybody around them. We figure in the 4 years we've been doing this, over 6,000 inmates in the three prisons that we've been in have been touched positively by Prison of Peace. And we've actually had some lifers get released because their transformation has been so amazing that the parole board, when they go up to board for release, has been totally impressed by how some of these people have changed. Not everybody. But some, and it's just amazing what happens when you teach people basic skills. We've had inmate after inmate come up to us and say, you know, if I had learned these skills 20 years ago, I wouldn't be here right now,
exactly.
Which is why we're rolling it out to the general public. And in fact, I'm going to start teaching it in the schools in the next couple of weeks. We actually have a pilot program going on in the Fresno Unified School District to teach these skills so that we can stop people from going to prison in the first place. Amazing stuff.
That's the big question, too, Doug. What is happening to people? I mean, we hear these horror stories all the time. Somebody robs a store, steals $10, ends up killing somebody in the store.
That's right.
Things like it. What possesses people to do that? Is it desperation? Are they insane? What's going on with them?
You know, I don't think that you can point to any one thing and say this is what it is, but I will tell you that the people that I have worked with in prison, to a person, I'll just take the women, they have all been raped, they've all been physically abused, they have all been drug addicted, they had horrible childhoods. I mean, I'm not going to excuse their crimes because each of them killed somebody, or many of them killed somebody in various legal degrees, but the fact of the matter is that people do heinous acts because oftentimes they have been treated heinously themselves, and they just don't know any better. Huge amount of mental illness. I would say if you include addictive disorder, drug addiction as a mental illness, which I do, then I would say that over 60 to 80% of prison inmates are mentally ill. No services provided. Zero, none, zero, zip, nothing.
Jeez.
And that's why the state of California has been sued so many times. And so when a guy goes into a 7-Eleven and a gun and he's high on drugs, he's mentally ill, he's completely out of control, he's totally violent, maybe he's high on meth, you know, absolutely crazed, you know, he's going to do bad stuff. Now, what do you do with somebody like that? He's done a horrible thing. He's killed somebody. What do you do with him? That's our challenge. And it's a social problem that is not going to go away, but it is costing us a friggin' fortune to incarcerate these people. There are better ways of dealing with this other than through incarceration for the vast majority of the people that are in prison.
Well, that's important. When you say the vast majority, what's the distinction here between, in your opinion, who would go to prison and who would not?
Well, again, I think it's going to be on a case-by-case basis. It used to be that way. The courts used to have a lot of discretion about their sentencing. But what happened was that our country moved in the Reagan administration in the 1980s, moved into what's known as sociologists call it the mass incarceration movement. And there was a reason for that. And the judges, both the federal judges and the state judges, lost their discretion. These determinate sentencing laws came down. And everybody got locked up for a long time. And then three strikes came along, embedded in Fresno, California, of all places. And, you know, that just made matters worse. So now there is no nuance in how people are sentenced. And it's very difficult to figure out what the right thing to do is. Of course, what happens is they get into the prison system. The prison system's job is to keep everything under control. They believe that fundamentally they're there to warehouse people, not to rehabilitate. They don't have the money for rehabilitation. The government is not interested in rehabilitating these people. And here's why this becomes important. Most of these people are going to get out. Most of them are going to get out. Not the hardcore lifers. Granted, they're in. But pretty much everybody else, 5, 10, 15 years, they're going to get out. They're not getting mental illness treatment. They're not getting rehabilitated. They're not getting educated. And they're coming back into the streets. What happens when they come back? With no training, no rehabilitation, nothing.
Give me your opinion.
A fortune.
If drugs were legalized, okay, all drugs, if they were just legalized, you don't go to jail for it. You get help, but you don't go to jail. What would happen to crime?
Well, I think that a huge amount of crime would be decreased because many, many of the people that are in prison are there for possession charges. I would be very careful about this, though. I would want to make sure that if we legalize possession and use, that we also provide rehabilitation services for mental illness and addictive disorders to a much larger degree than we do now. In fact, we could even tax the sale and use of drugs, which would pay for the system to rehabilitate people. Where I would still keep criminal penalties is on drug trafficking, because that's really bad stuff. And if you can get your drugs legally, there's no reason for drug traffickers to be out there. So I would still probably have laws on the books prohibiting drug trafficking. But I think that if we legalize drugs pretty much across the board, I think we would find that our system costs would go down. And especially if we invested into rehabilitation, we would find that we could probably rehabilitate a lot more people than we're able to rehabilitate today.
Well, and even beyond the taxing of drugs for the rehabilitation, the mere fact that you'd have less people incarcerated,
exactly,
you'll save money there too, right?
Exactly, exactly. And, it's tough, but part of the problem is that there's huge momentum against prison reform, and it's driven by dollars. The most powerful public union in California is the California Correctional Peace Officers Association. The reason that three strikes got started was a guy here in Fresno. I live near Fresno, California. Started with shot. Horrible situation. he decided to do something about that. So he started getting started petitioning the legislature to put away hardcore prisoners. The Correctional Peace Officers Association got behind it and realized this is a great job expansion program.
All right, hold on, Doug. We're going to take this break. We're going to come back and talk more. And we're going to take your calls next hour with Doug Knoll. Questions and stories. If you've been in the prison system, check in with us. I'd like to have you just kind of give us your story, if you would. Welcome back. Doug Knoll with us. Phones are ringing off the hook. We'll get to you next hour. We'll take a full hour of phone calls as we talk about the prison system and their project, Prison of Peace. And by the way, we have a link for you up there near Doug's name at coasttocoastam.com for a free ebook. Doug, would you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, the inmates that we've worked with over the years have, as I said before, have remarked about how powerful the skills are that they're learning. And it finally dawned on me that if I could roll some of these skills out to the public in a really effective way, that maybe I could stop people from going to prison in the first place. So that led to a creation of a website called, the easiest way to get there is it's puremagic.com. And if you go onto that page or the link on the show site, which is Negotiate a Centered Life, same thing, negotiateacenteredlife.com. I wrote a free ebook that talks about these basic fundamental techniques that we've taught in the prisons and acid tested there that are incredibly effective at dealing with emotions, dealing with emotional conflicts, and helping people de-escalate before they do something violent. So I'm really, really interested in getting, as I said, we're teaching this in the schools now, incredibly powerful stuff based on new neuroscience. And it's completely different than what everybody thinks it is. It is not active listening, something completely different. So you can go to puremagic.com, take you right to the link, look up. You can either buy the course, which is only $10, or get the free ebook, whatever you prefer. Anyways, powerful, powerful stuff. The stories that we hear from the inmates that we work with tell me that it is possible to take the people who are the lowest outcasts of our society and teach them skills that really change their lives, that make them valuable citizens again. We talk about taking people who are serving life sentences, yep, and giving them lives of service within their prison communities. And it's just amazing to watch what happens when you take these people, teach them these skills, and then have them come back and say, I stopped a riot, or I stopped two guys from killing each other, or I mediated a dispute between a prison guard and an inmate, or I dealt with these two people in a room who were about ready to, you know, who just couldn't get along. It's just amazing how this stuff works. And so it's really exciting for us. And the other thing it has taught us is that, you know, unless you're one of those small percentage of people that we talked about that are really incorrigible, most mm-hmm. of the people in prison can be rehabilitated to one degree or another, and they can be, if they're properly trained and properly supported, can come back in society as productive taxpaying citizens. And that's not how we're doing it now. We're not rehabilitating, and if people do get out because they're felons and they're ex-convicts, they are denied a huge number of benefits, almost impossible for them to get a job, very difficult to get educated, and they get into this vicious cycle of our society condemning these people, even though theoretically they have served their time, they paid their dues back to society, even though the slate is supposed to be wiped clean, that's the last thing that happens when people are released from prison. And we just have to make a decision about whether or not we want to continue to spend money on this stuff. It's costing us the education of the kids in the first place. The way you keep people out of prison is to educate them. You know, and when you're spending more money on prisons than education, you know you got your priorities back around. And the problem is really a political problem.
Do we know the percentages of people who get released from prison but go back in again?
Yes, the recidivism rate for people who have not been rehabilitated is astoundingly high. Something on the order of 70%.
Wow.
I mean, it's horrible. But when you look at how these people have been treated, not before they committed their crimes, how they were treated, most of them severely abused and drug addicted, they come into prison, they are stripped of all human dignity for the most part, and live in a very difficult environment for for as many years as they are, they're not given the opportunity for real rehabilitation in any serious way. And then they're released back out on the street, and now they're condemned again because they're an ex-felon. I mean, they don't have a chance.
No, not at all. And that tells you then that our current system of rehabilitation is all screwed up, doesn't it?
It has always been that way. I mean, when you use the word penitentiary, remember it was the Quakers who started the modern prison system in the United States. And the idea was to take a place where people could go and contemplate their misdeeds and become penitent. Penitent penitentiary. So there's always been this swing back and forth between rehabilitation and retribution. The problem is that whenever the politicians decide, well, we're going to try rehabilitation again, they don't give it enough time and they don't give it enough money. And so they say, oh, see, it's not working. We need to go back in a warehouse. And politicians don't get elected on rehabilitation. They get elected on being tough on crime. If you're running for the city dog catcher in Oroville, California, you want to put out there, I'm running for dog catcher. I've been endorsed by the Deputy Sheriff's Association of Butte County. That's what you want to put on your sign, even though being a dog catcher has nothing to do with the criminal justice system. I mean, these politicians feed on the fear of the population, and that's one of the reasons why we get into this situation in the first place. People have just got to wake up and make some decisions and not just allow Sacramento or any other state capital to spend the taxpayer dollars on these prisons and not get their bang for the buck. I mean, one of the things I ask people, I say, do you feel safer today, 25 years after the mass incarceration movement started, than you did then? And most people say, I feel less safe. Then as a business person,
yeah.
I would say...
I believe that.
And I would say, so what's been the ROI for the hundreds and trillions of dollars we spent on prisons in the last 25 years? What's our return on investment? If you're feeling less safe today, do you think that putting more money into a prison system that's not working is going to make you feel safer tomorrow? Logic says no. So we got to do something different.
What are the percents, you know, I'm going to talk with you about several crimes here for a moment, but, you know, I guess first-degree murder, you're in prison for life. You're not getting out. You might even get the death penalty. But
pretty much.
In terms of a child molester who gets released, you know, and then they end up living next door to you, you know, that's kind of freaky. But
it's tough.
I don't think, now I could be wrong, but I don't think a convicted child molester with any kind of rehabilitation in the current court systems and prisons gets rehabilitated. I think they generally might do it again.
I don't want to overstate because I'm not an expert in this, but I will tell you that I think that child molestation is a form of mental illness. And if we start looking at this as a public health problem, as well as a safety problem, we might be looking at other ways of dealing with this problem. Because if a person who molests a child is put into prison not for life, but that person's going to get out.
That's good.
And again, if you're putting them through a system where there's no treatment, there's no rehabilitation, there's no nothing, what are they going to do when they get out again? They're just going to go and injure and destroy other families.
Right.
So
I mean, I surely wouldn't want to live next to one if I had to. Would you?
Well, it totally depends. I 4 years ago, if you had asked me, would I want to sit down and have dinner at the dinner table with a convicted murderer, I would have said, you're out of your mind. But of all the people that I worked with in the prison system, there are only a handful that I wouldn't have at my dinner table. It's amazing. I mean, it's just amazing to watch the transformations. But the problem is that it's on a case-by-case basis. And so it's very hard to make blanket assertions. Clearly, the safety of our community is important, and we have to pay attention to that. The question is at what cost?
You should know, too, Doug, that the prison population is huge listening to this program, by the way. I get emails from prisoners and stuff. It's huge. So I just want you to know you've got a lot of prisoners listening to you tonight.
They're probably resonating with me. That's great. I mean, guy, for everybody who's listening, who's either in prison or has been in prison, I totally get where you're at. And you, for me to get up on a soapbox like this and be able to tell people the way it really is, I'm really happy to be a voice. And I'm not advocating that we open the doors and let everybody out. I'm just saying that if we want to be sensible taxpayers, and I don't care whether you're a hardcore Tea Party person or a social justice liberal Democrat, you've got to be concerned about this issue for different reasons, but you've got to be concerned about it. And it's something that is not debated. No, you don't hear anybody talking about this in the general elections. And I want to get this at the top of the list, and I want to be people talking about, okay, how come we're spending so much money, and how come we're not getting any bang for our buck?
And it's not, I want to talk with you for a moment, Doug, about vengeance. I could, for example, if a drunk driver horribly killed one of my family members, I could probably forgive that person if they went through some kind of massive treatment and rehabilitation and, you know, got off drinking and right. was penalized for driving, some kind of punishment like that. I don't think they should go to jail for 25 years for a mistake, a sad, unfortunate mistake. On the other hand, if like a Truman Capote cold blood type case happened to one of my family members, there is no way, no way I could forgive that person. I just couldn't do it.
That's right. So let me talk about that, because this is one of the reasons why we have the problem that we have. Vengeance is what we call an anticipatory emotion. It arises in the dopamine centers of the brain. Dopamine is a neurohormone that is that is the reward center. Whenever we learn something, we get a dopamine release. Whenever we do something good that we think is good, we get a dopamine release. We get high on dopamine. Dopamine is the fundamental cause of addiction. All right, so when we think about thumping the other guy because he did something brutal in the way that you described, we get a huge dopamine release. But here's the problem. If we are able to exact retribution on another human being, and maybe even it's righteous, just retribution, we get no dopamine release.
No, none.
And as a result of that, we feel depressed and let down. And as a result of that, we said, I must not have thumped him hard enough because I don't feel good about the thumping.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is, and the science is really interesting around this, it shows that when we are incapable of giving proportional punishment. There's a great experiment where they put little electrodes on two thumbs of two people, and the experimenter told them, okay, you're only to give as much pain, as much shock as what you delivered, and I will deliver the first shock. So the experimenter hits the button, one person gets a little shock on the thumb, and then the experimenter says, now you deliver exactly the same shock to the other person. It was twice as much. Then the person who received the shock dialed it up, it was four times as much. It was like a logarithmic or exponential increase in punishment back and forth, because we have no ability to know how much we're punishing. Now, you couple that with vengeance, and you can see how we get into this unconscious cycle of wanting to inflict more and more retribution, longer sentences, more death penalty stuff, and we don't think about the cost of all of this, and we don't realize how our unconscious is leading us down, a collective unconsciousness of our population is leading us into a path where we're spending tons and tons of money and not getting anything for it. The politicians play off of this. They do it unconsciously too. They don't know about dopamine, but they play off of this because they know people want vengeance. Now, to go back to forgiveness, I can spend a long time talking about it. I'm not going to talk about it all. All I'm going to say is that my experience as a mediator and having mediated thousands of disputes is that when people come into a mediation and they're in high conflict, they'd rather shoot each other with an AK-47 than sit down at the table and talk. They look at peace as being weak, mediation as being weak. It's kumbaya. It'll never work. Hear it every day. That's just part of the drill. What's amazing is that if you can work with people over a period of time, it might be a day, it might be a month, it doesn't matter. At the end of the process, when they finally do make peace, guess what they get? A big dopamine release. And the hugging and the tears and the forgiveness and all that stuff starts to come out. So our brains are perversely wired to force us to seek retribution, but when we get retribution, we don't feel good, to keep us away from peace. But if we do peace, if we do mediation, if we do resolve the conflict, we get the reward, we get the dopamine release. It's just a very bizarre way that our brains evolved. And that has led us to a lot of the problems that we've been talking about.
Oh, there's no question. But I mean, in terms of the type of crime, again, if somebody breaks into my house, kills a family member, assaults them, then kills them, I can't forgive that, Doug.
Yeah,
I can't.
It would be very difficult for you to. It would be very difficult for any person to forgive.
Could you? knowing what you know?
I think honestly, it would be a real struggle for me. But I also recognize that if I'm not able to forgive, and that forgiveness is a three-step process, if I were not able to work myself through that process, I would carry that injustice around on my back for the rest of my life. The only way that a victim can release the injustice is through forgiveness. And I'll just very briefly go through the process. The first and this could take a day or it could take a lifetime. The first thing you have to do is forgive yourself, because every single victim blames himself or herself for what happened. God doesn't love me anymore, something like that. So you've got to learn, as a person who's been victimized, think about how to forgive yourself. If you can do that, and that's a huge if, but if you can do that, then you start thinking about, can I forgive the event? Can I forgive the circumstances under which all this occurred? And that might take a day or it might take a lifetime. It might never happen. If you can do that, big if, really big if, then you can start thinking about forgiving the person. And again, that might take a day, it might take a lifetime, it might never happen. But only if you go through those three steps will you ever be able to forgive. And unfortunately, if you can't go through these three steps, you're going to carry a huge psychic burden on you for as long as you
can. Oh, it's a pain that I think would never go away.
Exactly. So forgiveness, when we think about forgiveness, we think about, especially of a heinous act where a loved one has been murdered, for example, callously, we think about it would be impossible to forgive. But as time goes on, you have to realize how long are you going to carry the burden of that with you. And at some point in time, if you want to live a healthy life, you have to learn how to never forget, but you have to put the burden back on the offender, and you do that through a forgiveness process. That's been my experience. I've done a lot of criminal mediations, victim offender restorative justice work, and that's how I've seen it play out. Not everybody can do it. And you should never be told to forgive, which is a big problem in the faith communities. They exhort you, forgive your enemies. No, wrong, totally wrong. Creates more damage. Don't do that. So you have to make the decision yourself that this is the right thing for me to do. And it takes time. It takes a long time.
Oh,
and the more heinous and grievous the murder or the crime, the longer it takes. Yeah. And some people will never recover from it.
I mean, the fact that I could not forgive them under those kinds of situations doesn't make me a bad person, does it?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And the question becomes, you know, for your own mental health, for your own psychic peace, how long do you want to continue to carry that? And that's fundamentally the question that people have to ask themselves. But you're right. There are too many. When people have been victimized, either directly or indirectly, they're victim survivors. Their friends and colleagues don't want to be around them. Get over this. They go into what we call emotional devaluation, which I talk about in the online course, where we emotionally debate, come on, get over it. This happened 10 years ago. You're still crying about that. What's your problem?
I hear this emotional devaluation people.
All the time, and that it's devastating to victims.
I know people, Doug, who have gotten divorced, and it takes them years.
That's right.
To get over it, and
that's right.
and that's in a divorce situation.
That's
so
right.
I can imagine. In a crime situation, I mean, I could forgive someone who steals from me. I could forgive that. I could forgive the drunk driver. I could forgive that under proper conditions. But the hardened criminal, the murderer,
it's a real tough ethical, moral, spiritual, mental, emotional dilemma for which there is no easy answer. And that's why we need a criminal justice system. We do need some kind of incarceration system.
All right, hold on, Doug. We're going to take calls with you when we come back.